Director of Finance and Government Operations Committee is called to order.
Has everybody been able to look at the minutes? Anyone wish to move them? Chair. Thank you. Any discussion?
No.
All in favor? Oh.
Actually,
Chair Freiberg.
I think March 18th was the day we had two hearings, so would they be moved separately or? Okay, so I will move the minutes of the 1 p.m. March 18th meeting of the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee.
Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Minutes are approved.
I can move approval of the minutes of the 5 p.m. meeting of the March 18th version of the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee.
Chair Freiberg has moved the second set of minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes pass. And the first bill is HF 4319.
Chair Quam and members, I move HF 4319 before the committee.
And there's a amendment?
Yep. And then also, since Chair Freiberg had last week was able to do a couple of amendments, that was just good governance. I'm hoping the committee is favorable to the same, but my A1 amendment that I'm moving forward with this is... I have Lake City is the underlying bill, and to give you a little bit basis on that bill, that was turned into a port authority or a given authority to be a port authority in 2021, and that happens through the legislative process. Then the city is to file some paperwork with the Secretary of State, and some of that did not get done. So right now, what the underlying bill is to correct that. The A1 amendment is very, very simple. This is also a Port Authority, Red Wing, and the term limits were originally set at 6 years, and then around 2011, Red Wing changed that to a 3-year term, and so Amendment 1 simply turns it back to being a 6-year term. It's a very, very simple fix.
Any discussion? Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not opposed to hearing this, certainly. It looks like, actually, from the timestamp, it more than met the deadline anyway. I'm curious if there are testifiers here, like from Red Wing, or just if anyone in the audience had any, I mean, as far as I know, it's fine to move from 3 to 6, and obviously it's a very limited applicability, but just wanted to make sure there was no issues with anyone who might testify on this or anything like that.
To the author?
Mr. Chair, and there is a letter in your packet that the Red Wing supports it. So,
great.
Sorry, I forgot to mention that.
Anyone from the audience wishes to testify? Seeing none, seeing no discussion.
So, no. And then there's another amendment, Mr. Chair.
Let's finish up with this one. Seeing no discussion. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there is another amendment, the A2 amendment. And with this, I invite up a testifier. This is another correction amendment, Kent Sulum, to describe it to the committee.
Welcome to the committee. And even though I've known you for many years, please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Chair Quam, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sewell with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. And what this amendment is doing is, a year ago, Representative Rarick carried a bill that modified the sizes of the governing boards of certain municipal utilities. And it created a process for decreasing the size of the board, but was not as direct on increasing the size. And so now this amendment just simply says if you're modifying the size, there's a 45-day period between when the council recommends the change in size and it taking effect, during which the citizens can petition for a referenda. That protection only existed going downwards. This protection is going up or down.
Thank you. Any questions? Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it looks from the timestamp like it met the deadline, but was this actually posted? I guess this seems, mm-hmm. You know, the bills we put together, it was posted to the committee website? Okay. Because it is a broader change. In that, you know, the underlying bill deals only with the city of Red Wing, and this appears to deal with all city utilities. But it does appear to be a fairly minor change, and I vaguely do remember that bill from last year. I don't know if any of my colleagues have any questions, too. I'd be interested to know that.
My interpretation is that instead of the language was unidirectional, and it's making it so it could be bidirectional, increase or decrease. And since the other amendment actually has a increase, that was for years. Sorry about that. Does anyone have a question? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm just reading the amendment now, and it looks like most of the changes are changing reducing to modifying, but I'm curious why that is not followed on line 1.20. Is that optional? And so the ballot question would either say reduced or the ballot question would say increased, right, depending on the situation?
Yes, that's exactly why it's there. They have to choose if they're increasing or decreasing for the wording of the ballot.
Representative Lee, did you need further clarification?
Nope, that's good. Thanks.
Seeing no other discussion, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes. To the author to discuss your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I will call up my two guests now for testifying. It's a very simple bill, and you can hear directly from the members from Lake City.
Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Doug Grout. I am the Lake City Port Authority Executive Director, and I'm joined today by our City Administrator, Robert Keene. Thank you, Representative and members of the committee. Very briefly, as the representative had mentioned previously, the Lake City Port Authority was created in 2021. Previously, the economic development activities for the city were handled through an economic development authority, and the city council in 2021 decided to transition that to a port authority to access other funding that may be available for identified projects locally. The legislation passed in 2021 creating the port authority in Lake City, and since 2022, the port authority's worked on manufacturing plant expansion, workforce housing development, and we provided many loans to small businesses, often in partnership with local lenders. We realized when we were notified by our city attorney, which is Kennedy and Graven, last year, that the League of Minnesota Cities was aware that appropriate documents were not filed with the Secretary of State when we were created in 2021. It's a certification form, basically, that had been passed by the City Council. After several attempts to refile, we were instructed that the way to address this was to come before this committee and the legislature for approval of a retroactive bill that would establish us back to 2021 as the city council had done. The principles and the reasons behind it, the principles involved in that at the time are no longer with the city or working with the city. There's a number of people involved in it, and we're here to fix that problem and move forward. So with that, the Senate passed a companion bill last week, which was SF-4455. The Senate, the State and Local Government Committee of the Senate passed that. And with that, I ask Rob if he has any closing comments or final comments.
Mr. Chair, members, we do appreciate the opportunity to come here and present this proposal. Our city council supports this. I am here in lieu of an elected official because they were unavailable. But there is strong support for this. We've been doing good work down in southeast Minnesota and Lake City. It's something we'd like to continue to do, and this will help us do that. So thank you again for your time.
Questions from members? Any other testifiers from the audience? To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is just a fix-it bill, and we appreciate your support to make sure that Lake City can be continue with their economic development that they are seeking to do. Oh, sorry about that. With that, I move that HF 4319, as amended, would be referred to the General Register.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. So moved. Your bill goes on to the General Register. And Representative Gordon, if you'd move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move HF 3295 before the committee.
And you've got, do you have any amendment?
Well, let me just speak to the bill real quick, and then we'll talk about the amendments, if you don't mind. When I was first elected as mayor of Isanti, prior to this job, I wanted to be as transparent with the public as possible. We began live streaming council meetings on Facebook against the advice of our city attorney. He expressed concern that state statute didn't clearly define the ability of a public body to live broadcast through social media or how to address the comments section regarding data practices and the public comment portion of the meeting. HF 3295 would clear all that up and hopefully lead to more public bodies live broadcasting meetings, which in turn would lead to a more engaged and informed electorate. And as you said, we do have the A3 amendment, I believe, that was going to be offered.
Representative Lee.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I'd like to offer the A3 today. I can talk a little bit about what the amendment would do and also the intention for it. I've spoken with Representative Gordon about this as well. I think our colleagues here, share the interest and share the value of transparency and also making sure that, our neighbors, community members, regular people who don't usually tune into, say, election committee meetings or, city council meetings are able to access these meetings in, whatever format or media people are consuming today. The reason why I'm offering this amendment is it seems like, the underlying bill has, I guess, well, so first, the underlying bill is permissive. So, right, it allows bodies to broadcast their meetings on social media, which, I think is a fine, good thing, especially as social media platforms have become another venue of distribution of media. And, if we can use this as government entities to, share what we're doing here so that, more people understand the process that affects them, I think that's great. The concern comes in when we make this more participatory and less using social media as just a distribution platform. And so the A3, is supposed to level the playing field so that, regardless of whether this question of the move to social media is, regardless of whether it's just participatory or if it's, or rather just distribution or participatory. This is supposed to be a good thing so that regardless of whether you have an account on X or Facebook, if or whatever platform is being used, that you can access this, right, by a mere link, because you can kind of do that sometimes, but not on all platforms. So that's this First Amendment, but the general concern is more, if we're going to use social media platforms, you know, I think it's okay to use them as distribution channels so that more people know, more people see what's going on, but the larger concern I have is using it as a participatory platform. So I'm going to leave it there, and, you know, I would love a discussion on the A3 and, you know, see if the author will accept it.
To the author.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're right 100% about the language being permissive and trying to give public bodies as much flexibility as possible, for sure. So, yeah, I would accept the A3 amendment and, yeah, I'd encourage everybody to vote yes on it.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I did have a question for nonpartisan. There was some concern that maybe this would apply to state agencies and that type of thing. And so I my intention wasn't to have it apply to state agencies. I mean, it's all by request by the desire of the public body to use this new language in general. So it's not something that anybody has to do or is being forced to do. So I don't see that as being necessarily a concern, but is it possible we could add an oral amendment that would make it, you know, maybe in paragraph C of that subdivision that this language does not apply to state agencies?
Ms. Griffin.
Chair Quam and members, so the open meeting law under Chapter 13D does apply to state agencies in addition to other local bodies or public bodies, including local governments. To do this as an oral amendment, I think, would be difficult. I think I'd have to look at Section 13D.01 and then identify the public bodies that you'd like to limit the language to. But I'd certainly be willing to work with you on that amendment.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's something that if that is a concern, we can certainly work on it on the floor. Of course, we're up against deadlines, so we want to try to get this done as, you know, as quickly as possible. So, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, my interpretation is if you're doing excluding and stipulate what you're excluding, we wouldn't have to worry about defining the ones that weren't excluded.
Well, that would be my interpretation as well, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. But I agree it probably would be a good thing to run through all verifications for the appropriate wording. Any discussion from members? Chair Freiberg.
So what is the motion on the bill? Is it being sent to the GR or? Okay, because I do think if it applies to state agencies, it probably should go to the State Government Finance Committee. I mean, you know, we already do have a pretty full agenda on Wednesday, but I could endeavor, if we can put an amendment together just to address this issue, you know, we could also, by Wednesday, we could try to add it to the agenda for that day too, if you like.
No, I understand. We can hold the hearing to amend it so it wouldn't have to go to the committee that we're having the hearing at. But if the author, to the author.
I guess I'd prefer to get it out of committee so that we're not, you know, pushing up against the deadline. And I know you're going to be pushed for time on Wednesday as well. So I think that would be what I would prefer. And I'd like to see it go to the general register. And then I can certainly work with nonpartisan to get that amendment added so we can take care of that issue if it's a concern. And like I said, nothing in here is forcing anybody to live stream. So it's not like it, I mean, it may apply, but it's only if they would prefer to use it. So, but I'd be happy to amend it if
needed. Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you. So just wanted to add to this discussion, you know, very often we say like state and local governments, don't create foreign policy. But I think the concern is that because this affects state agencies, you know, with the also the option of allowing entities to take the social media comments and add them to the official record is a little bit disconcerting. You know, as we know that there are a bunch of bots on all the various social media platforms that we use, you know, we don't want Russian bots influencing, you know, policies that our state agencies carry, right? And would probably rather choose people who actually live in Minnesota and their comments. So I think that's why, like, we think it's really important to bring this to the correct committee. And so that's just the concern that because this does allow public entities to record these comments, you know, there's no way to know if these are actually real people commenting on their communities or someone, you know, in another country. So, thanks.
So my interpretation is that the representative or Chair Freiberg would like to hold this over and then you'll hear it Wednesday at the same committee. With the amendment.
Yeah, yes, sure, if that's agreeable, sure.
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the key word, Representative Lee, is allow, right? So, I mean, the state agencies would still have the ability not to do it. But I don't. My intention wasn't to apply this to state agencies in the first place. So, Chair Freiberg, I trust you. You're an honorable guy, and I've enjoyed working with you. If you say you can squeeze it in on Wednesday, I'll trust you that we can do that, and we can add the amendment and get it through quickly. So.
So then the author is moving it as amended, rolled over, or.
Well, I'll move it to be laid over and as amended with the A3 amendment, yes.
Then it is laid over. Your next bill. I'll be taking House File 3589 off the table.
Thank you, Mr. Awesome. Chair. I do have an amendment that came from the Secretary of State on this, the A1 amendment. It just adds clarity for our election judges. I think it was very well written, and I appreciate their help with this amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Oh. Representative Lee.
I support the amendment. I think it's the proper fix, so thanks.
Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of.
Well, I don't know if I made the motion, I guess, or if you just pulled it off the table, right? But let's see. So we've got, where am I at? Voter approvals. So I would move that HF 3589 be passed to the General Register as amendment.
We have to amend it first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was calling for a
vote. I'm in such a hurry. We've got such a packed meeting today. I'm trying to.
Seeing no further discussion on the amendment, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Amendment passes. To the author.
All right. Now I'll move that HF 3589 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. It passed and moved on, and we're on your third bill.
Okay.
Of which I would move to take House File 3587 off the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To the author.
All right. I do have the A1 amendment. This also came from the Secretary of State and kind of cleared up the, was it election judges versus judge? This makes it judge, so each individual judge can carry one ballot from outside the polling location and in. And I appreciate the Secretary of State's office for the help with this.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes. To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that HF 3587 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And it passes.
Thank you, guys. I'll
switch over to the Vice Chair. Oh, I guess I can stay here. I would I move to take House File 3588 off the table. And apparently there are no amendments. So are there any questions on this? It's basically allowing easier continued action of what's already basically being done, so that we can get voter lists registered for the major parties, so they can organize and do their activities. And they're already allowed to, but this allows for the national level, the major parties, to help with that coordinating on the federal elections in the state. So I would move that HF 3588 be recommended to pass and be referred to the general registry. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We are moving along at a fairly good clip here. And now, Representative McDonald. And to the author.
Mr. Chair, thank you, fellow committee members. House File 4295, also known as the Chicken Shift Bill. That's the shift bill, chicken shift. And folks, the chickens are coming home to roost. What? Was it that bad? And that is why we need this bill, ladies and gentlemen, because we do need the chickens to come home to roost and allow for people to be able to have chickens in their backyards and on their property. Over 11 million people in the United States right now are raising chickens due to the cost of eggs and other circumstances. They're almost like a pet, like a cat and a dog, but even better because they give you some sustenance. But the reason why this bill is in front of us today is because the county, we need clarity for the county feedlot officers and allow Minnesotans to be able to keep backyard chickens without unintentionally being subject to regulations meant for other purposes. This bill responds to the concerns that some Minnesotans keep chickens in their backyard. Coops may unintentionally meet a definition of a feedlot. Hence the term, chickens are coming home to roost. In the state law, and therefore being subject to state regulations that are intended for large agricultural operations. The solution is proposed in this bill would give county boards the option to adopting an ordinance making clear that state feedlot regulations don't apply to small chicken coops. A county's ordinance could allow for up to 24 chickens on a lot, but counties maintain the discretion to adopt smaller size number of chickens. That's a good thing. The bill in front of you right now was crafted in response to conversations with my good friends in Wright County that you'll hear from and various agencies that began last year. The MPCA and the Department of Agriculture have each communicated their comfort with this approach, and that's a good thing. So we feel that this we have achieved peace in the pasture on that front. I didn't write that, but I like that. That's good. Peace in the pasture. The issue was first raised to me by, as I said, Wright County, but you will see in the record, for the record, there's also a letter of support for this bill from the Association of Minnesota Counties. With me today is the Wright guy from Wright County, our County Administrator, Greg Kreiser, and that is my testifier, Mr. Chair.
And to the testifier to the right of the author, please introduce yourself and to your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Greg Kreiser. I'm the Wright County Administrator, and I'll be honest and forthright here. Also, a proud owner of 4 backyard chickens. So, this bill addresses an unintended consequence of the feedlot regulations, and it does so by giving local communities the ability to adopt a local ordinance. The Association of Minnesota Counties supports this approach because it reflects that local communities across Minnesota are different. Your materials include a narrative, which I provided you, and a few aerial photos of a pasture in southern Wright County alongside Little Waverly Lake and the 12 Mile Creek. If you turn to page 2, it's kind of an aerial, larger photo of kind of the area, but then the last page has the zoomed in image of what is 13 dairy heifers having a wonderful time at pasture grazing. To do the math here, a heifer is 0.7 animal units, and with 13 heifers, that's 9.1 animal units. And they're perfectly legal out there in the pasture having a wonderful time out in southern Wright County. Now, when you apply that same math to chickens, a chicken is 0.005 animal units. That would be equivalent to 1,820 chickens walking around in the same pasture. If all those chickens are walking around out there doing what chickens do best, that is, would be completely legal pasture. But if we put one of those chickens in a coop, it would meet the definition of a feedlot. And because it is in a confined space where manure will accumulate and where vegetation will not grow, it then becomes an illegal chicken coop and an illegal feedlot. So this bill addresses that inconsistency by giving counties the option to adopt a local ordinance exempting backyard chicken coops of up to 24 chickens from the feedlot designations. Counties can choose to act. Counties that don't are under no obligation to adopt it. We worked through this carefully with all the stakeholders last session, and the bill before you reflects that consensus, and I'd urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And I, before you mentioned it confined, I was worried that my bird feeders were maybe against the rules too. Any members? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this forward. I have to tell you, this is giving me flashbacks to my time on City Council when we debated backyard raising chickens in your backyard in the city of Bloomington. But it did actually prompt a question, and I think maybe Mr. Gehring is going to be the one to answer this. So this bill, as I understand it, would allow counties to adopt regulation ordinances. I guess sort of my question is, what if a county adopts an ordinance, say Hennepin County, and then the city of Bloomington has a separate ordinance related to how many chickens are able to be contained, for lack of a better term, on someone's property? Sort of which takes precedence, which sort of takes priority there?
Ms. Chelsea.
Chair Quam and Representative Coulter, I don't know. That's a great question. I'm happy to look into it for you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate this. I have neighbors. I live in the city, but I have neighbors who have backyard chickens. I'm wondering if, Representative McDonald, do you have a coop for backyard chickens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, sometimes my wife wants me to be in the coop, but no, not yet.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. I am surprised that I'm the first one to make a old McDonald has a farm joke, but like that's it. Where I was going. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Well, perfect.
You know, and I want to make sure that we give Representative Coulter an opportunity for a humorous exchange. Okay. Chair Freiberg.
Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I have a boring procedural question. I know there's so many. I know the humor opportunities on this bill are so rich, but where was this bill being referred?
It would go to the Environment Committee.
Okay. I think that's appropriate. I heard from the Environment Chair that they thought this should go there, and I do think Representative Coulter raised an interesting question too. Maybe before it gets heard there, we could just get some clarity on that question too, even though it won't be in this committee at that point, but it would just be good, I think, for members to know that. So appreciate it, and I think that's the appropriate motion.
Well, thank you, and frankly, we don't need the Gordon bill to be able to watch that committee over the internet. Any other discussion? To the author.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Committee members, I appreciate your support on this. Just in closing, just to remind folks, if you are not aware of the saying, the chickens come home to roost, what it means is it's a negative consequences of one's past actions, mistakes or wrongdoings, or bad decisions. And eventually that will catch up to them and cause more problems. And that is why we need this bill to help all of our chicken farmers who'd like to have a little chicken fund. Did you say, Representative Greenman, you have chickens in your backyard? Oh, you want to? Well, once this bill becomes law, I'll help you collect the eggs. With that, Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much for your support. And I re-renew my motion for House File 40, what number is it? 4295, the Chicken Shift Bill, to be re-referred to the Environmental Bill, Environmental Committee, rather.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All of opposed, nay. And it passes, and it's flying off to environment.
Excellent. Thank you, Greg.
And Representative McDonald, do you have a another bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I am helping out Representative Ben Bakeberg, who is not able to be here. So I am helping him out for his bill, which is House File 3571. So I'll make a motion to move House File 3571.
And there is a DE1 amendment.
And I have a DE1 amendment. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any discussion on what, or would your testifier be able to tell us the changes in the DE1?
I sure hope she does. Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so, please state your name, affiliation, and...
Oh. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, my testifier is here to testify on the bill, but not the amendment.
Oh.
So if House Research, Ms. Griffin can tell us what the A1 amendment does.
Ms. Griffin.
Chair Kwan and members, the DE amendment adds towns and watershed management organizations to the entities that qualify under Statute 471.617, and there's also a new subdivision. If you look at Section 5 on page 3, this defines a watershed management organization. For the purposes of Chapter 471, that term is defined in this manner in one other section, so this is conforming with the similar language in that chapter.
Do members have any questions on the DE1? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, actually, I did have a little write-up on the amendment, but I'll tie this in, and then I'll forward it over to my testifier, Ms. Joni Giese. Mr. Chair, members, House File 3571, on behalf of Rep. Bakeberg, I thank you for hearing the bill and let you know that the other co-authors are Rep. Cha and Tabke, so it's a bipartisan bill. The DE Law Amendment simply adds permissive language allowing watershed districts, watershed management organizations, and townships to the list of local government entities that can join a health insurance pool, and that's a good thing. With that, I send over to my testifier, Ms. Joni Giese, Mr. Chairman.
And please state your name, introduce yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Sir, Mr. Chair, Kwam, and members, my name is Joni Giese. I am the administrator of the Prior Lake Spring Lake Watershed District, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 3571. So this bill was brought forward to Representative Bakeberg from a group in Scott County called SCALE, and that stands for the Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency. And this group includes representatives from Scott County, municipalities, school districts, townships, tribal, and watershed districts. And what we try to do with this group is to collaborate, to seek opportunities to increase local government efficiencies and leadership. So for the past several years, using our scale group, Scott County municipalities in the Watershed District have been investigating the feasibility to form a self-insurance pool for health benefits. And just last year, we came to learn that state statute does not allow watershed districts or watershed management organizations to self-insure or to join self-insurance pools. And we would very much like the opportunity to explore this option to provide health benefits to our employees. Minnesota Watersheds, the state organization of watershed districts and watershed management organizations, passed a resolution in favor of this legislation, and the bill is supported by watershed districts throughout the state. Thank you.
To the author. Did nope.
Are, oh, I'm good, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience wishes to testify? Seeing none, questions from members? Seeing none, to the author.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again on behalf of Rep. Bayberg. It's an honor to be able to help him out. I think we all agree that those good folks at the watershed districts who make sure that we have good water flowing through our neighborhoods and communities are able to have some health, good health group plans and health insurance, and that's a good thing. So with that, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion for House File 3571 to, go to the General Register, Mr. Chair?
As amendment.
Oh, as amended. To be sent over to the General Register.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And the bill passes.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you're the best.
And now we're moving along pretty good, members. We're on our last bill now, the eighth bill. It may take a little longer. And would the author, there you go. And Representative McDonald?
Yes, sir.
Yes, hang on, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 3895.
And
the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
So you wish to move House File 3895 before the committee and refer it to the General Registry. Is that your motion?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair. Thank you for clarifying.
Thank you. To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for moving the bill in front of us today. Yes, we're going to have to do some procedural stuff to get the bill in the shape to present for the committee. So, yes, the DE1, I think I'll save going through the whole bill until we go through everything, but the DE1 is the collaboration that's occurred on this bill for the last 16 months. So there's been roughly 30 iterations, and this is the final kind of agreement that we're working on right now. So that is the DE1 amendment.
And McDonald moves the DE1 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes. To the author.
And I believe we have one more amendment, Mr. Chair, the A8, which was given to me by House Nonpartisan to just kind of clean up some of the grammatical errors and make the bill flow a little bit better.
And Representative McDonald, well, McDonald would move the A8 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move the AA. What is it? AA?
Eight.
Oh, A8. Yes. Amendment.
Not seeing any discussion. All in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment passes. To the author.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for helping get the bill in the shape it needs to be for presentation today. This is the Minnesota Starter Homes Bill that has been a part of a robust policymaking process that started 3 years ago, and we're here today. And before I get into the bill, I want to just talk about why this bill is in front of us. And the first number I'm going to give out is 40. That is the median age of buying your first home in the state of Minnesota. And why that number matters is because 42% of the population of the United States is in that age group, it is in that generation. And they're not able to afford homes until they're towards the end of that generation. We're 100,000 housing units short in the state of Minnesota, and the median mortgage has risen to $2,600 in the last 5 years. This issue stems from accomplishing something that I think doesn't matter your party. You'll see here, Representative Kraft and I are presenting the bill together today because we want to highlight more important than ever that this isn't a red or a blue issue. This is an issue getting back at the root of what it means to be not just a Minnesotan, but to really believe in the American dream. And home ownership is at the core of that. And the ability to own a home is core to that. So this bill is a collaborative approach that has a coalition that's been built up over the years and conversations, like I mentioned earlier, we're probably on 30, probably isn't good enough, Representative Kraft. We're probably on 35 or 36 at this point because we wanted to make sure we got it right. And we're still working on it, and you'll hear that today through testimony and through some of the things I'm going to go over as I explain the bill. But it's important that we make a step to reduce mandates, cut red tape, and most importantly, give personal freedoms back and private property rights so people can buy and build the homes that they want. So inside the bill today, there is roughly 12 different subdivisions that I'll just go over briefly to say the meat to the bill. First, if you go starting at the front of the bill, most of the first page, half of the second page is your definitions, explaining what everything means in the statute if it were to become law. First section will be your administrative reviews. This is just permitting reform for housing, frankly put, to make sure that there's steady and reasonable timelines so that developers or personal people who want to build their own homes have reasonable timelines to get their plans approved. The next subdivision is the static mandates, and this is getting at removing those mandates that we see put on some housing. Prime example, when you enforce that you have to have brick fascia or three-car garages or so many windows, you're increasing the cost of buying and purchasing that first-time home. We need to be able to allow the free market to work and people have choice to build what they want. The next subdivision is the HOA preemption, which I won't go into. This committee already passed it out, so I know that conversation was had. Number six, the next subdivision is around mixed housing and greenfields. So this is about getting at that when we develop and look into new developments, that they include those duplexes, quadplexes, in 33% of it. And that is an active conversation that we're still having with cities as we manage how that rollout would look. But the thought process behind it is if you're building a new community, or a neighborhood, I should say, is a better way to put it, that if you have abilities for senior-type duplexes or young family quadplexes, row housing, you get communities that can live together no matter what stage of life they're in and build stronger communities. The next part is getting into accessory dwelling units, or ADUs. This is becoming more and more popular, not across Minnesota, but across the country, for your quote-unquote mother-in-law suites, so that people can look at diversifying their home properties, whether it is to help take care of family, or maybe it's to help bring that kid home from college that can't find a home in their communities right now. The next would be multifamily and commercial. I wish I could say that this was a new idea that me and the fellow bill authors came up with, but it's getting back to the core principles of who we are as Americans. Every single small town in America has a downtown district with apartments above it. And we started pivoting away from that, and we're finding out that this is a really important part to making sure that there's opportunity for people to live but where they work and play where they work. So whatever stage of life you're in, we're seeing that it's a very important part of who we are in our communities. Getting after that, we have what we like to call the menu option, and this is what we did. We broke down based on what tier size city you are or class you are, class one, class two, class three. There's certain menu options that we're asking you to reach as a city. So some of those revolve around parking minimums, some of those revolve around multifamily and commercial or mixed-use development. There's a whole slew of options in there so that cities are able to pick and choose what works for them and also get credit for what they're already doing. And that's been a place of vivid collaboration with groups around the state. The rest of the bill kind of gets into, well, I think one of the most important provisions, which is the infrastructure and environment provision. And this is something that we really worked on for over months because, as we find out, every city is different. Also, land is different wherever you go. So making sure that if there's, whether it's riparian rights when you're talking lakeshore, whether it's soil conditions when you're talking infrastructure, it's so that the provisions in this bill won't supersede things that are protecting the environment or the infrastructure of a city. And then the final couple subdivisions are just making sure that if this was to become law, there can't be official controls used or interim ordinances put in place to stop the implementation of this bill. And then finally, the implementation date is January 1st of 2028, which again is part of our vivid and very dynamic collaboration and kind of negotiating we're having. But members, that is the bill. I really can't emphasize enough how much work has been put into this bill and what this bill is really seeking to accomplish. You know, when you look at what's happening around not just Minnesota but around our nation, it seems to be that Republican and Democrat politicians can't agree on much these days. But I encourage you to listen to a podcast from Governor Newsom and Vice President Vance, who didn't agree on a dang thing until they talked land use and zoning. And it was the one thing they agreed on. And we're seeing it work in states like Florida. We're also seeing it work in states like Washington. And it's a way to make sure that that American dream of homeownership has free market ability to prosper and come back to states like Minnesota and across our nation. So that's my rundown of the bill. I'd love to defer to my co-author, Representative Kraft, for a few comments as well, if that's all right.
Rep. Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be in the committee. Thank you, Representative Igoe. I'd just add a few things as to why I've probably worked on this bill more than any other the past few years. Really, and it starts from when I've been out in my community door knocking. I can't tell you how often I've heard the refrain, hey, I've lived in this community for 20, 30, 40 years, but my kids can't afford to live here. Or, you know what, I work here and I can't afford to live here. You know, things like that that really, you know, tug at you. And I realize that to address this, we need systemic solutions. So that's why I'm really interested in this. The other piece is, you know, we have this big housing shortage. Where we build the housing really matters. You know, I know one of the concerns is how that I've heard in a variety of committees is how much land we take out of farmland, for example. Well, the number one driver of farmland coming out of production is development. So being able to intelligently add housing in places that can prevent more sprawl is really good for all of us, as well as we put less of a time tax on people in terms of how much time we force them to spend in their cars driving to and from where they live or work or want to play. I also want to say that there's no one magic bill that will answer the affordability issues and the supply issues we have in housing. But one part of addressing it is absolutely dealing with housing supply. And this bill is about making it easier, faster, more predictable, and as a result, less expensive to build more types of housing in places that are closer to places that people work, go to school, and play. I also want to comment that these issues, you know, this gap isn't going away. It hasn't gone away. What we've been doing in the state and across hasn't been working. And so this is, I believe, a state-level problem. You know, I'm a former city council member, so I don't put together work on legislation like this that touches on areas that cities are very much involved in without a lot of thought. And I'll also say that this bill has changed dramatically since the first set of bills we put forth three sessions ago. And it's a result of a lot of feedback from city groups, from planners, from advocates. And while we've been doing that all along, it really went into high gear from last session to this, where we started over the summer. We got language well before session started. You really will see a move away from prescriptive towards a lot of city choice and just a real focus at trying to build in things that we, that not only we, but other parts of the city organizations will say, hey, you know what? We can actually implement this. This stuff is implementable. So with that, I guess we have some testifiers.
The first two testifiers are Nick Erickson and Martha Jolimol. I'm not sure I did a decent job on the pronunciation. Please give us your name and your affiliation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kwan, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota, where our mission is homeownership opportunities for all Minnesotans. And I'm glad to be here today with our bipartisan bill authors and join more than 1,000 Minnesotans who signed our petition asking legislators to say yes to home this year. Now, as you've heard, this conversation has been going on for years. In fact, we're on year 8. This stems from the 2018 Task Force on Housing. And since that time, our housing shortage has doubled. The cost of housing in Minnesota continues to climb. We are between $50,000 and $100,000 or $200,000 more costly to build here than in other neighboring states because we aren't doing anything. The plan for the last 8 years has been to just admire the problem. Our housing permits are plummeting. We are seeing property values rise, which is raising everyone's property taxes. We have to do something, and really today is an opportunity to act. This bill is a result of months of work between our bill authors, cities, planners, housing advocates, and the housing industry all coming together to find a bill that is implementable but also effective at addressing the critical barrier, and that is the lack of housing and the roadblocks that exist to get to build those homes today. And what we're asking for you is just simply to vote yes on this bill. We can no longer go down the same path of doing nothing and admiring the problem. As you heard from our bill author, that the median age of the first-time home buyer in America is now 40. The new generation of Minnesotans are being priced out of home ownership, and that's not the Minnesota way. And today in front of you is the opportunity to act, to protect home ownership, and to ensure that the next generation of Minnesotans have a place to call home. Thank you.
Thank you. And please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Martha Angelomali. I am an economist at Center of the American Experiment, and I'm here also to support House File 3895. As an economist, I generally prefer that housing and land use decisions remain at the local level. However, we need to accept a practical reality here in Minnesota, and that is our current system is no longer functioning for the average Minnesotan. Compared to residents in similarly situated states, Minnesotans, especially those in the Twin Cities, are being shortchanged when it comes to housing. With the median home price exceeding $400,000 in 2024, the Twin Cities region was the most expensive housing market among the top 10 Midwest metros. After adjusting for income levels, we were the fourth most expensive housing market among those 10 metros. The empirical evidence is clear. This crisis is driven by stringent regulations, particularly at the local level, that delay development and raise costs. By dictating exactly what kind of housing can be built and where, how large lots must be, and even how housing must look, local governments have inadvertently engineered a housing crisis to the point of restricting personal freedoms and pricing Minnesotans out of economic opportunity. Currently, mixed housing and multifamily housing is effectively illegal to build in vast parts of our cities. Even where it is permitted, technical barriers like Minneapolis's floor area ratio of 0.5 or St. Paul's lot coverage rules render development practically infeasible, even if legal on paper. All throughout the state, requirements such as parking minimums and aesthetic mandates also increase complexity and add up to tens of thousands of dollars to the price of a single home. House File 3895 is a necessary response to the housing affordability crisis. It is also structured to ensure that local governments remain in control of their communities while operating within a more functional framework. I urge this committee to support this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. And the next two testifiers are Peter Butler and Steve Wilson. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Kwam and Freeberg, along with the rest of the committee, for having me here today. My name is Peter Butler, and I'm currently a council member on the Coon Rapids City Council. I am here today to express my views and support the Starter Homes Act. When I campaigned in 2024, housing came up every day. I'd have new families tell me about how they couldn't afford rent or how they know how they could never afford a house. I'd have seniors tell me that they weren't sure where they would downsize to after stairs or other parts of their home became a challenge for them. I'd have a lot of residents tell me about how their kids and grandkids wouldn't be able to live here. And I'd even have residents look at me and say, Pete, where am I going to live? My wife and I experienced similar conversations when we bought our first home in 2022. Our first house is in Orrin Thompson Rambler, which is a single-story cozy home that's great for first-time home buyers. These homes sold for about $13,000 in the 1950s, and adjusted to today's dollars, that would be $150,000. We paid $285,000, and some of these shoot for $300,000 or more. This means that in Coon Rapids, which is frankly cheaper than a lot of the metro area, starter homes are still going for $300,000 or more. Even when you're paying 20% down, when you're thinking about your mortgage, taxes, insurance, that means you're looking at a monthly payment of $2,000 or more per month. That's also the case for apartments. Apartments in Coon Rapids, not California and not New York. My house turned 70 this year, and I'm thinking a lot about housing markets and how they've changed. It would be illegal to build an Orrin Thompson Rambler and for him to build them in many parts of our community today due to restrictive zoning laws, which partially explains the inflated cost. I am so appreciative of what this committee has focused on over the past several years in an attempt to address this affordability issue. Lastly, I do want us all to think back to the first time we purchased a home. Think about how you cobbled together that money, how difficult it was, and the challenges with it. That opportunity feels like it's out of reach for many Minnesotans right now. I hope that you can consider supporting this bill in an effort to deliver where cities couldn't. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Wilson. Thank you. And then our next testifiers after Steve, Mr. Wilson, are via Zoom. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, good afternoon, co-chairs Quammen and Freiberg and members of the committee. I am Steve Wilson, city council member in the city of Farmington. I was kind of getting a chuckle out of Representative McDonald's chicken comments, because you'll find a lot of chickens down in Farmington, no surprise, and of course a lot of farm fields. The city of Farmington is a rapidly growing and beautiful city on the southern edge of the Twin Cities. We're at about 25,000. I am speaking in opposition to this bill, 3895. This is not, in my opinion, a common sense piece of legislation. I do understand it's been a number of years in the making. In contrast, I believe this is a set of mandates that would preempt Farmington and other communities across the state with unnecessary administrative burdens and development standards that do not solve affordable housing. I would argue that this bill actually has possible implications of increasing the cost of housing. Zoning and land use planning are at the core of local government under the Minnesota Home Rule Law. We are now embarking, as many communities are, on our 2050 comp plan, and this bill would take away the important local planning done by professionals and replace this by administrative regulations. Please think about that. Do we really want the state of Minnesota now involved in building versus city officials and city planners, city commissions, who know our council and or know our cities better than anyone else? We don't. Farmington itself, now keep in mind that every community is very, very different. Farmington itself, including just last week, a week ago today, has approved over 800 housing units in just the past 12 months. We modified our zoning to accommodate a higher density product in our community from a national builder, represented by the association advocating for the passage of this. So there are communities out there that do want higher density housing, and we are not a community that's looking to create arbitrary or restrictive ordinances that bar those. And I'm sure our comp plan will reflect that. I would also point out that Farmington in particular has worked with the Dakota County CDA. For those that don't know what a CDA is, that is a community development authority. That is a partnership between the city and the county and the federal government. That's both been for low-income housing, not only for first-time homebuyers, but seniors. Seniors also face the same type of challenges. I personally work in the senior market and hear that every day. So members, I do urge you to vote no on this House file. I do understand it's been years in the making to get to this point. I still believe that the work of cities and the partnerships that we have with builders is important and vital work that we do. And I would also point out too that cities, as a city council member, we are not the enemies. A good city council is the best advocate for housing, and the best advocate for our communities. So thank you.
Thank you. And the next testifier is on Zoom, Gabe Kravitz.
Hi, Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity, members of the committee, to testify today. I'm Gabe Kravitz from the Housing Policy Initiative at the Pew Charitable Trusts. We're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. I grew up in Minnesota. I get to provide a bit of a national context for the policies under discussion today. The provisions in HF 3895 are similar to measures taken in other jurisdictions that have proven successful in increasing housing supply, lowering costs, and reducing homelessness. The evidence for the effectiveness of these policies is quite strong. ADUs, accessory dwelling units, rent for less than either single-family houses or apartments in new buildings, and they're often affordable to those earning 80% or less of the area median without government subsidy. Reducing minimum lot sizes in Houston has enabled the construction of 80,000 new starter homes and townhouses with prices that are typically affordable to those families that are earning the area median. Another one, easing parking mandates and allowing more apartments, especially on commercial corridors, which is one of the menu options in the bill, has helped keep rents nearly flat in Minneapolis from 2017 to 2022, even as rents rose 14% in the state overall and 29% nationwide. And finally, middle housing, like 2- and 4-unit homes, consistently have lower rents than single-family houses or high-rise buildings. So Pew's research shows that policies that enable housing and mixed-use buildings in commercial areas are particularly effective because they speed up permitting and reduce the onerous requirements that have previously stymied apartment construction. Housing built near commerce can enable both affordability and walkability, reducing traffic and commuting costs. And when there's enough housing for residents in cities and towns, it also prevents sprawl and reduces miles driven, helping to protect productive agricultural land. So in light of these successful outcomes, 14 states, including Montana, Texas, Washington, California, and Florida, have passed similar laws on a bipartisan basis, making it easier to build housing near jobs. And 18 states have passed laws to enable ADUs. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. The next testifier on Zoom is Lloyd Hilgart.
Oh, I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the board for allowing me to speak today. My name is Lloyd Hilgart. I am the mayor of Monticello. And I would like to just start by saying we appreciate the efforts of the legislature to address housing supply and cost issues and the work put into this bill. I want to assure you that cities like Monticello are also putting time and effort into housing solutions that work for our communities. For Monticello, these efforts have produced real results to meet housing demand and address housing costs. Monticello has proactively implemented a variety of tools to address housing demand, including solutions for affordable and missing middle housing. We have adopted by right, small lot, single family zoning and ordinances to support two-family and medium density zoning. These have resulted in the development of over 200 new small lot or attached single family homes over the last 5 years. The conception that single family zoning limits higher density housing opportunity is not reality for Monticello. Monticello, a community of just under 15,000, has approved construction of over 500 multifamily units in the last 10 years. We've also approved mixed density single family residential projects that will result in the development of over 470 new single family attached and detached units over the next 5 years. Monticello needs to retain its proactive land use planning and flexibility in zoning tools so that we have the best chance of meeting the housing demand specific to our community, providing for the full spectrum of housing choice for residents. As presented, the bill is fairly prescriptive in approach and could actually restrict or constrain our options for housing affordability and choice. We're asking the committee to allow cities the ability to continue to use creativity and innovation in developing a affordable housing options for all. Well, that was my script, but what I really want to say is, if we want to talk about affordability and we want to look at why some other states have housing that's more affordable than ours, we really need to look at all the energy codes that have been implemented by the state over the last 20 years that have added tens of thousands of dollars to the cost of building a house. And I'm in the new construction industry, so I'm well aware of all the things that have changed in the last 20 plus years that have added to the cost. And it's not the permits from the cities, and it's not the sack and whack charges. There's so many other things that go into this, including I would dare say the hangover from COVID and 3% rates that almost made the price of housing almost double in the last 5 years. So there's a lot of things right now that have made housing very unaffordable, but I think it's not due to the local level. I think there's a bigger thing going on, and I think we just gotta wait for this to kind of play out. But I don't know. I'm assuming most everyone there has served at the local level, and I'm assuming also then if you did serve at the local level, you know that we typically tend to have the best idea of what is the best for our cities. So definitely against this.
Well, thank you for your testimony. The next testifier, again on Zoom, is Rick Blake.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Huam and Freiberg, other members of the committee. My name is Rick Blake. I serve on the City Council in Grand Rapids, which is located at the very northern tip of committee member Representative Davis's district. I'm also on the board of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. While there have been modifications to this bill, cities continue to oppose it as being too preemptive of local control and not flexible enough to recognize the diverse needs and circumstances of individual cities. Cities across the state have already doing a lot to encourage more housing, including utilizing many of the kinds of strategies called for in this bill, but they are doing it in their own way and in dialogue with local residents and other stakeholders. For example, in Grand Rapids, we have adopted a zoning classification we call R1A zoning. It allows narrower lots, 44-foot lots, in an effort to get more single-family homes per foot of sewer and water, since this infrastructure is so expensive. We have made changes to allow higher building heights. We have always allowed multifamily and commercial zones, and we're currently considering changes to allow for additional density based on number of bedrooms. For example, less bedrooms, more density. Our city has cultivated good partnerships with developers. It keeps them coming back. As an example, we had one developer who mistakenly placed an advertisement for apartments for rent in a new building in Grand Rapids that was actually located in a different Rapids. He started getting calls. As a result, he called our community development department asking about our housing needs. He has since built two large apartment complexes, and because of the experience, is considering a third. An efficient building permit review is one of the things we do to make it easier for developers. We also take advantage of programs from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board housing grants. In addition, we utilize tax increment financing and tax abatement as development tools. And we use collaboration. We recently utilized a land trust model and worked collaboratively with Itasca County Housing and Redevelopment Authority, the Grand Rapids Economic Development Authority, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, and One Roof Housing in Duluth to develop two former school sites into single-family housing. These are just some examples of what we have done in Grand Rapids to increase our housing units by 20% since 2010. In conclusion, despite the changes to the bill, it remains problematic for cities and does not tackle the real challenges we have with housing development. Taking away our ability to solve our own problems through legislation that removes local control and flexibility is not the answer, and in fact may hamper our ability to come up with creative local solutions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Our next testifier, again on Zoom, John Redermacher. Sorry about
that. Thank you. No problem, Rod. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is John Rademacher. I'm the city administrator in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, a city of 4,000 people, which in this bill would not be subject to a lot of the regulatory aspects. However, we are a community that is striving to grow and actually have efforts in place to want to achieve a population of over 5,000 people, at which time a number of these regulatory preemptions for local control would kick in. I want to speak today about a couple of the projects that we've done that do fall in line with activities that this bill tries to implement or force for cities. We actually worked with a developer to develop an apartment complex within a commercial district that fell outside of our normal code. However, the demand was so strong and the interest for doing this, providing the 79-unit market-rate apartment was so great that we were able to work together within our local tools to allow for this project to be implemented, utilizing a TIPS district to help us pay for infrastructure improvements that were needed for the site. And I'm proud to say that about 3 months after it was opened, it was fully occupied. So there are tools and things that we do need, but we utilize those to help bring down the costs to make them more attractive and competitive for those financing. An additional project that our city and Economic Development Authority has been working on is actually land that is owned by our Economic Development Authority to be developed for single-family housing. Thanks to this partnership and a zero interest loan from our economic development for the purchase and development of this land, we've been able to develop right now 28 lots that have all been either built or are under contract to be built for single family homes. We're currently working on the development and sale of another 25 lots, ultimately with this full development being 100 lots for our community. What this project has helped us to do is keep the lot costs relatively low for this area so that the builders and buyers for that want to construct on these homes are finding that they are becoming into the more affordable and financing range. So the challenges that we see are not necessarily the local legislative restrictions that we have. They are really into, in our size communities around the state, they're really more in that construction costs, as you know, Mayor Hilgert from Monticello spoke to. Those costs are putting the pricing of housing just outside of where they become, you know, fundable projects for these homeowners. When you can utilize the tools that we have to bring those costs down, you do see where they get into the kind of variables where they become financially viable for these homeowners and developers to construct this housing. So for us, we would much rather see more tools in our toolbox to be able to help fund these projects and make them more accessible for communities like ours to be able to acquire. As you know, Councillor Blake spoke to, there are lots of options that are happening at the state, and I just want to make sure that those are utilized and encouraged and made available for even small communities like ours to be able to acquire so that we can continue the support in trying to develop more housing. Thank you.
And thank you. And next is Kelsey Clem.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for giving us this opportunity and be able to do so remotely. I'm Kelsey Clem, the city administrator for the city of Detroit Lakes. We've actually just hit over that 10,000 threshold for population. And in addition to the objection regarding the preemption of local control, I wanted to speak to some of the specifics in the bill. First, the prohibition on design standards. You know, this is not going to impact our zoning controls in Detroit Lakes because we don't impose any of those listed aesthetic requirements. The reality is that the only design standards that are applied in Detroit Lakes are by the developers in the form of covenants, not by the city, something that this bill does not control. Second, the prohibition on HOAs is actually quite problematic for us in Detroit Lakes. Around lake shores and our other areas of our community, we've utilized creative zoning applications for a number of housing developments through a planned unit development process, in which case there's always some common element or common amenity that the developer wants to include in their development. For example, as you imagine, we have a lot of shared dock systems, are very common in Detroit Lakes, but we also have everything from shared green spaces to pools being built in these developments. In only these instances, the city then requires an HOA to maintain these developer-built amenities so they don't become burdens on future taxpayers. I understand this bill allows cities to adopt ordinances requiring these common elements to be maintained, but I don't know how ordinances will be effective if the developer is long gone or there is no association to hold responsible. Detroit Lakes is one of the fastest growing areas of the state. We've added over 440 units over the last 7 years, and that's a mix of single family, multifamily, and mixed use. We want to build more, we're trying to build more, but this bill does nothing to improve affordability in our area. This bill does not lower the cost of 2x4s or lowers the cost of labor for new construction. While it may have good intentions, it's just another unfunded mandate being levied by the state on municipalities. And I say unfunded mandate because this will take considerable staff and consultant time to update our comp plan, our zoning ordinances, and utility plans. I think it'd be remiss to not at least acknowledge that there are going to be voters in our communities who do not like ADUs and maybe higher density in our neighborhoods, especially in rural Minnesota. And believe me, I've been through a lot of these hearings and they're not a lot of fun. But at least that is a policy discussion and decision that's made at a local level. And that's something that they're afforded today. But this legislation would silence that viewpoint. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're back to testifiers in the room. Kylene Lindgren, and then after her would be Rianne Lee. Welcome back, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Colleen Lindgren. I am a senior state policy manager at the Pacific Legal Foundation. And we're a nonprofit public interest law firm that represents clients free of charge in constitutional cases. We've litigated over 2,400 cases in the last 50 years, and we've had 18 U.S. Supreme Court wins, many of which were related to the area issue that brings us here today, which is protecting property rights. And as a native Minnesotan, I am thrilled to see this bill considered. House File 3895 is not about giving undue power to the state. It's about giving power back to Minnesotans, to individuals, to homeowners. And there have been a lot of great things said, and I don't want to belabor a lot of the points that have already been said. But so in the interest of time, I just want to highlight three key things that this bill does that I think are particularly impactful and putting Minnesota back on a better course toward protecting property rights and protecting people as they do that. First, this bill holds permitting authorities accountable with timelines and administrative reforms that allow municipalities to address their own unique concerns, but ensuring that processes don't hold up projects. Delays and unknown timelines create uncertainty, they discourage investment, and they increase costs. And in a time when homelessness and housing costs are at high records, localities should not be exacerbating these issues. Second, this bill legalizes accessory dwelling units that can provide essential housing for family members and even renters, helping people be able to afford to stay in their homes. And lastly, it provides more pathways for diverse housing options like townhouses and duplexes, which are an essential piece of the housing market for many Americans. And one such American is an individual that Pacific Legal Foundation represented in Montana. In 2023, you may be aware, there was a package of housing reforms very similar to what we're seeing today. It was passed. It was called the Montana Miracle. And one of the things that that did is allow for duplexes to be built. And that's a pretty common thing. And it's shocking that our client couldn't do that before. But Mr. Kenk is aging himself, and he has two elderly brothers who are veterans, and he had a lot next to his house that he shared with his wife, and he wanted to put a duplex on that house so that his siblings could live close to him. They could all help take care of each other when they were, as they were aging and dealing with health issues, and he wanted to respect his brothers and their service in this way. And in 2023, he thought he was going to have the opportunity to do that. And unfortunately, some neighbors sued and tried to stop Montana from implementing the reforms that it had enacted. And again, this was a suite of about eight different reforms. And just last week, the Montana Supreme Court sided with the state and upheld these laws. And Clancy is not the only individual. There are many across the country who benefit from these things. So in closing, I just want to congratulate the sponsors, the committee, for hearing this bill that provides practical, meaningful steps towards prioritizing Minnesotans and their housing. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brianna Lee. I serve as the Legislative and Coalitions Director for the Americans for Prosperity chapter here in Minnesota. And you have heard a lot of numbers, including in my own written letter and materials. So what I want to do is spend my time focusing on telling you what we are hearing from Minnesotans, your constituents. We are the nation's premier grassroots organization. Grassroots is our bread and butter. It's what we do. We talk to people. And what really sets us apart is our focus on individuals and applying bottom-up solutions to public policy. And that is one thing that we see in this housing bill. Over the last 2 years, we knocked over 500,000 doors in Minnesota on policy accountability. In 2025 alone, we spoke with more than 100,000 Minnesotans, and I have a little chart here. Over two-thirds expressed support for this housing bill. Second was about 33% of people that are like, you know what, I don't know exactly, in true Minnesotan fashion. They're like, I'm not really quite willing to commit to yes or no, but I really like what you're saying. I like what I hear. We have met moms who are like, I love my daughter, but I want her to move out. It's time. We have met the newlywed couple that are like, I can't afford to buy a house, and I don't know when I ever will. And then we've met the family that have aging grandparents, and they were blocked from building an ADU that fits their needs. So I think, members, a lot of these stories are very consistent, and we are approaching 250 years since the Declaration of Independence affirmed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I want to remind you that property rights and home ownership have been core to the American dream, and excessive regulations are continuing to put that American dream further out of reach for Minnesotans. And there's a hostile environment that is preventing the market from meeting consumers and what they are asking for. And across districts and demographics, again, they are telling us that it is unaffordable to get a house and something needs to be done. So when we return to your districts, we are going to be talking about accountability and what happened at this legislature. And we hope that we can tell them that you took the bold reform to answer their asks and to take action and do something today and pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Foster. And next after that will be Connor Carroll and Eric Searles.
Chair Quam and members of the committee, greetings. My name is Jornelle Foster. I'm the Chief Impact Officer at the Groundbreak Coalition. And we are here today in strong support of the Starter Home Act. The Groundbreak Coalition includes over 40 philanthropic, private, and civic organizations that are pooling expertise and capital to support generational wealth building here in Minnesota through home, business, and property ownership. At Groundbreak, we know a home is more than a place to live. It is an investment in stability, in community, and wealth for the next generation. Through deep collaboration, Groundbreak is mobilizing capital for 11,000 new homeowners over the next decade, providing up to $50,000 per household for down payment assistance paired with loans from a network of lending partners. Our goal is to make ownership possible at scale for communities who have been excluded from wealth building for generations. Many factors, including restrictive zoning rules, have contributed to the home ownership and wealth gaps that we see here today in Minnesota. Without policy change, efforts to expand home ownership will be stifled. Competition for the existing stock of starter homes is driving up home prices. Low vacancy rates and rising rental costs are making it harder for families to even save for a home. The Starter Home Act addresses Minnesota's housing shortage and responds to the needs of many first-time home owners who are looking to buy smaller single-family homes, duplexes, and townhomes that are much more affordable. While zoning laws have historically been used to exclude people, this does not need to be our future. We all benefit when Minnesotans have stable housing and generational wealth that comes from owning a home. In a recent social return on investment study, found that every dollar in Groundbreak's home ownership initiative returns $5.25. Each household with low wealth that is able to own a home in Minnesota gains $132,000 in lifetime benefits from higher income, children's educational gains, and better health outcomes. We urge state leaders to pass the Starter Home Act and ensure that more Minnesotans have the opportunity to live, to thrive, and to afford the places where they wish to live. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Connor Carroll and then Eric Searles.
Hi, my name is Connor Carroll. I live in Minneapolis. I'm a volunteer with Neighbors from Our Neighbors, and I'm here to speak in support of the Starter Homes Act. I grew up in Rosemount, and after college, I wanted to buy a house in the neighborhood I grew up in, but the available homes were and are far outside my price range. Most of the homes are big with large yards, 2 and 3 car garages, more space than I actually need. Smaller homes are almost non-existent, and rental apartments were also unaffordable for me. In 2015, I moved to Minneapolis because the rent was cheaper and there were more options. I'm happy in Minneapolis, but sometimes I wonder what my life would have been like if I had been able to afford a starter home and if that had been an option. When I grew up, my grandmother's house was a block away, and my aunt and cousins lived 2 blocks away. We could walk over and drop in whenever we wanted, unplanned, and I remember a lot of spontaneous family time in my childhood because of this, and this made us very close. And that kind of upbringing has just not been available for the next generation of my family. My sister and her husband ended up buying in the northeast suburbs because that's what they could afford. If we lived closer to home, I could see my niece and nephew more and help with childcare more. My parents are close to retirement, and being closer would make it easier to help them when they need it. The Starter Homes Act would make it easier for families to afford to live closer to one another and maintain strong bonds and help preserve and strengthen close-knit communities. I've been a part of this effort here for the past 2 years, and it's been really encouraging to see the extensive good faith negotiations taking place this session with decision makers from both sides of the aisle. Given the intense polarization of our time and the fact that this is an election year, I urge you to support the Starter Homes Act and take this opportunity to show the people of Minnesota that common sense bipartisan housing reform is possible. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Searles, you are the last of the testifiers. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Searles. I represent the city of Woodbury. As a 25-year professional planner and as a city of Woodbury, I am grateful for the work invested in addressing our housing shortage by the authors of this bill. We share the same goal, creating more housing, especially more affordable and attainable housing. The challenge is that the proposed bill attempts to solve density problems through zoning mandates rather than through thoughtful, comprehensive planning. Minnesota is unique in that we have a regional planning agency in the Metropolitan Council and a longstanding state law requirement that cities adopt comprehensive plans, and that's served us very well. These existing planning systems are where changes should be made to increase the production of housing, not through unpredictable zoning preemption. Zoning preemption is unplanned growth, which will lead to legal challenges and costly infrastructure burden for our taxpayers. Also concerning is nothing in this bill requires the construction of affordable or attainable housing.
instead. The legislation is built entirely on the hope that the market will deliver these much-needed products or will free up units via trickle-down economics. Hope is not a strategy. If any level of local preemption is to occur, it should come with requirements that the intended housing prices and housing products will actually be delivered. Two additional technical provisions illustrate why this bill will not deliver the intended results. First, the bill allows ADUs without any maximum building size square footage. Without that cap, what was meant to be modest, attainable starter homes will instead become full-scale second homes on properties, pricing out the people that this policy seeks to help. Second, for greenfield cities like Woodbury, the mandated 1/8 acre minimum lot size would certainly come with costly infrastructure upgrades to both existing and future municipal services, as the proposed minimum is more than double the density in our approved 2040 comprehensive plan. A state mandated minimum lot size would also eliminate the ability for cities to ensure a mixture of townhomes and single family homes are built, and instead would leave it up to private builders and developers to decide what is built versus local officials. In closing, cities across Minnesota strongly support the shared goal of adding more housing. But from a professional implementation perspective, the current bill contains numerous issues that must be addressed if we are to achieve these goals together. Thank you for your time today and for your commitment to this important work.
Thank you. And Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to request a roll call, please.
A roll call has been requested. Thank you. The author?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We were just wondering if myself and Representative Kraft can make some comments to all the testimony we just heard before we go into member questions, if that's all right.
I'm sorry, I was getting double feedback.
I was asking, Mr. Chair, if it would be allowable for me and Representative Kraft to give some comments back from all the testimony that we heard before we go into member discussion.
That's what I had intended, but I think Representative Akam did have a question or something besides asking for a roll call.
I did have some comments, and so would like to take a minute and make those if now is the appropriate time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard from a lot of people today about this bill, and we heard the theme I heard most was affordability, and that this is the Starter Home Act, and there is nothing in here that is going to ensure affordable units are built. There's nothing to ensure that. The costs of homes are, there's many reasons, from land price to lumber to labor, and those are all really important. And I think that addressing affordable housing is really important. And I think we heard from a lot of our cities today who testified, and from the city that I represent, who have prioritized affordable housing and are doing it in a way that they don't have the preemption and still doing it. Bless you. And so as we consider this bill and what it does and what it doesn't do, what it does is give the power, not to the people, as one of our testifiers today suggested, it gives the power to the for-profit developers who want to come into our communities and maximize their profit. They want to come into my community. They're not going to build a story and a half home that was typical of post-World War II that would be great for, a lot of young families. They're not going to build that in my community. They're going to maximize the profit. They're going to build a big home. Over the many months and years that we've had the conversations on this bill, I've appreciated the conversations, especially with Representative Kraft. And one of the things I've talked to him about was, this isn't an affordability bill. And he said, no, it's a supply bill. And I said, well, some would argue that supply is actually addressing affordability. And Representative Kraft said, no, that's not the case. This is not an affordable housing bill. In the conversation, and I see your furrowing your brow, that was my recollection of the conversation, because I was relieved to hear you say that this was not a direct affordability bill. And I heard from Mr. Searles the concerns I have, which are around kind of the slow and indirect impact on affordability by only addressing supply. And so that's a concern. And another one of the questions that I asked Representative Kraft was about if affordability is important, and I know we're hearing from everyone in our community about affordability, why are we not including things like inclusionary housing? And he said, well, the developers are telling us we can't do that. Well, I think the developers are saying we can't do that because that impacts their profit. If you look at the national builders and their agenda, it's about getting rid of inclusionary policies. And so if we are looking to address affordability, which I think we should, we can look to some of the important communities that talk today and others that are actually implementing affordable housing. And for those communities that are not, we need to hold them accountable. I'm on board with that. All of our communities need to be helping in the solution. But unfortunately, this bill isn't going to do that. We heard from so many, every single person, I want my children, I even heard from the bill authors as I took notes, can't afford, you know, your 40-year-olds are the ones that you can't buy a home on average until you're 40 years old. And it's an affordability issue. But this bill isn't going to make it more affordable in my community for them. And outdoor knocking and hearing about the importance of affordable housing. Again, this bill isn't going to do that. So, members, I encourage that we allow our communities who have elected officials who represent and are accountable to our constituents be allowed to continue to do the good work cities are doing. And so I'm clearly not in support of this bill, in case you hadn't figured, but just to make it clear. Appreciate the presentation today, and I appreciate the conversation and all of the testifiers that did come to testify today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And to the authors.
Yeah. Well, Representative Kraft, go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, Representative Akam, on the what I said was that this is targeted at a supply side, and supply is one aspect of addressing affordable housing in the long term. If you misunderstood that, I apologize. But I do think that this is a systemic structural issue, and that dealing with supply is one tool in the toolbox that we must address to deal with affordability. I want to comment on a few other things that were said. There was a comment made of, do we want the state of Minnesota involved in local building? Well, we are. We do building codes that address building across the state. Cities can't do that. We have stormwater regulations, tax incentive financing, how plats are subdivided, or even zoning itself. These are all state constructs. There were comments made about limiting the innovation or taking away the ability to solve local problems. No, that's not what this is doing. All right, and you can read through the bill. It doesn't take away a city's ability to solve local problems. We are asking everyone to up their game. And you could hear from all the cities that testified how they said, well, I'm doing this part of it, I'm doing this part of it. In fact, many, if not most, of the provisions here came from ideas that we heard about and learned about from cities. There was a comment about homeowners associations, HOAs. The thing that the testifier described, that situation would allow a city to require HOA. If a developer wants to put in some kind of a facility that requires an HOA, then it can be done. So the language is on 412, 413. I appreciated the comments from the city of Woodbury. I'm actually coming to meet with them in about a week or so. And the ADUs was actually some language that we took from cities, but I've heard that same comment about size, and I think we're willing to work on something to make it clear that ADUs can't be bigger than the main unit. So we continue to be open to it. There was a comment made that we are not the enemy from cities. Well, neither are we, right? There are many individual cities that are doing great and creative work in this area, but one or a few cities can't address the problem on their own. One city is doing good work, but their neighbors aren't. That city's effort will be quickly swamped by all the unmet demand out there. So what we're asking is to raise the bar a bit across the board.
And we are seconds till the normal ending of the committee time. So, you know, maybe a couple more minutes, but if we want to do a vote, then we need to move to that soon. Thank you.
I'll defer my response then for my closing on the bill then, if there's more member questions.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do my best to be brief. Thank you, Representative Igo. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for your work on this. And I know this has been a tremendous amount of work, and housing was actually one of the issues that motivated me to run for city council in the first place. When I read this bill, what I see is a balance of flexibility, and I'll be honest with you, I think there's actually more flexibility in this bill than would be in my ideal bill. But it strikes a balance between flexibility and focus on what the goal is. And, you know, Representative Kraft, I think you hit the nail exactly on the head, that we have to make a systemic change. And I heard a lot of folks say that essentially that we can just keep doing things the way we've always done them. And I will tell you, even going back to my days on a city council, there is no justification I think I hate more than, well, that's the way we've always done it. Because the way that it's always been done is simply not working. And I just want to remind folks that government overreach is very much a thing on the local level. It is absolutely possible for local governments to overreach. And I have seen it happen time and time again in communities across the state. And the result is, when it comes to housing, that not only are we punishing the communities that want to do the right thing, but we are punishing the people. And this bill is not everything, but it is something. And I'm grateful for that, and I am going to support it. Thank you.
I don't see a question in that, but Representative McDonald, quickly.
Mr. Chair, we really haven't had a chance to visit as members to ask questions, and now we're running out of time. I think that maybe if the authors would have make a motion to lay over so we can bring this up again. You're shaking your head. Okay. Well, I would agree with Representative Akam. There are some concerns that this doesn't bring down the cost, but we don't know. None of us have a crystal ball. But we do know that in Minnesota, it's much more expensive to build a house. It's $47,000 plus more dollars to build a house here, same house, same team, same construction company, than in Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. A lot of it is because of our stringent regulations and mandates that we have here. The Green New Deal we go completely green and fossil free by the year 2038 will even exponentially raise the cost of building anything, and making this bill, it'll negate that bill if we ain't able to stop that. So what I haven't heard is anything that we can do to bring down those costs, that we're not competitive with our neighbors. Our neighbors aren't doing this kind of bill, and they're still 25 to 40% less to build in our other states. So I think we need to address those things. I did have a question on the bill, but I guess, Mr. Chair, we don't have time to discuss. Maybe if you have allow me to ask one question of the authors regarding subdivision or 7.15 regarding Representative Igo, the subsidy. I was just curious. It says on 7.15, page 7, it allows for provides upfront subsidy for development of single-family detached homes with a purchase price of $500,000. Now, $500,000 doesn't seem affordable, but if you're in California, it's probably very affordable. So affordable is very vague, depending on what city or state you live in. So in regards to that subsidy, is that coming from where exactly for those?
To the author.
Yep. We'll handle this in tandem. This is part of that working menu that's been in vast collaboration with the cities, learning about things that much of the testimony we heard today, we heard about things that are working in cities. So we tried to capture that and put it into the bill here so that people get credit for what they're doing. So this subsidy went, and I'll, Representative Kraft will go into a little bit, but it's, go ahead, Representative Kraft. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So this is one of the menu options, so it's not required, but if a city wants to, as a menu option, pick an item where they refund some city fees for new homes that are built that cost less than this, they can do that. And this is modeled after actually a program that's successful in Rochester.
Okay, the authors want to do a closing since we got about a minute.
I'll just make a brief closing. Thank you, first off, for the time today, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you to all the testifiers. There's just a couple things I want to hit on, and I'll wrap this up. The first, this issue, the reason I'm so passionate about it and enjoyed working on it with so many folks is the generation of Minnesotans we're talking about is the generation I am a part of. I don't get the phone calls about the hot-button issues that maybe sometimes Republicans and Democrats throw bombs at each other about. I get the calls on this one from my friends scattered around the state of Minnesota that want a place to call home. We heard a lot about today about communities need to be free to make those choices. Well, folks, the friends and kids that are trying to move back to the homes that they were from don't have a voice in those city councils because they can't live there because there is no homes. That's an important part to this as well. But most importantly, the ask in moving this bill forward today is keeping this conversation alive. Let's keep the collaboration moving forward. Let's have another rendition of the bill, and let's give ourselves some more time to find a bill that works for everyone that was opposed, just like it was for everyone that was supportive today. Because this is doing something that's cutting mandates, cutting red tape, and it's doing it for zero physical cost. Thank you for your consideration, members.
Thank you. And with that, Representative McDonald renews his motion that House File 3895, as amended, pass and be referred to the General Counsel. Please take the roll. No.
Mr. Chair,
the motion is to the General Register. Basically, the deadline to get through. So, take the roll.
Chair Quam?
No.
Chair Freiberg?
Yes.
Vice Chair Alsendorf?
No.
Vice Chair Lee?
Yes.
Representative Acom?
No.
Representative Coulter?
Aye.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Gordon?
No.
Representative Greenman?
Aye.
Representative McDonald?
No.
Representative Roach?
No.
Representative Vernig?
Yes.
There being five ayes and seven nays, the bill does not pass. And I'm laying it on the table. And we are adjourned. Thank you.